to start with the next chapter, and this chapter will address issues on pipelining. On a more general topic, we are talking about instruction level parallelism, which means we want to exploit the possible parallel execution which lies within the level of different instructions. And if you look here, what techniques we have exploiting instruction level parallelism, we have, first of all, pipelining, what we are discussing now. We have superscalar, which we'll be discussing next, after pipelining. We'll have very large instruction word, which we'll be discussing then, after superscalar. And we have EPIC, explicit parallel instruction computing, which is some kind of mix of, or a hybrid, between superscalar and VLIW, and which we will discuss as well after. So the sequence will be, first we'll look in the lecture now on instruction level parallelism pipelining, then we'll look at superscalar, VLIW, and we want to look at EPIC, just to distinguish this from thread and task level parallelism. Thread and task level parallelism means, just to show you this again, on instruction level parallelism, I exploit the possibility, ILP, instruction level parallelism, I exploit the possibility of parallelism between different instructions. Let's say instruction, I just write it not in assembler mnemonics, but in arithmetic notation. A is given by B plus C. C is given, don't use C, so don't use it now already. Oh, we'll come to this a bit later. Let's say D is given by E plus F, and K is given by A plus D. Just an example. So here is some inherent parallelism. If I look at instruction 1, instruction 2, there is no relationship, no dependency between these two instructions. They use completely different operands. So there is no reason why not execute these two instructions in parallel. On the other hand, instruction 3 has dependencies. 3 uses result D and the result A. So it's not possible to execute instruction 3 in parallel to 2 or 1. But in fact, these two instructions can be executed in parallel. So here we have instruction level parallelism. If we would have a powerful hardware, this processor could execute these two instructions completely in parallel, while this instruction had to be calculated in the sequence. And these techniques we have here use just different principles to exploit this parallelism. For instance, finding out if instructions be executed parallel dynamically or statically by the compiler is a difference between superscalar and VLIW. While thread-level parallelism or task-level parallelism, TLP, just exploit, this is as well called fine-grained parallelism, exploit coarser-grained parallelism, when I have a program, and this program, for instance, contains of thread 1 and thread 2, then this is thread-level parallelism, so I could execute these threads in parallel, as well as processes, as heavyweight threads. And thread and task-level parallelism exploited by multi-threading. This will be as well a topic in our lecture after discussing this. Multiprocessing and multi-cores, clusters of computers, cloud and grid computing. So in this lecture, we will discuss these up to, when I have new slides, I have to reestablish the pen here. So we'll just discuss this up to here as well in this sequence. So pipelining first, then superscalar, VLIW, EPIC, multi-threading, multi-processing, and multi-cores. And we want to start with pipelining. Okay, let's look at instruction-level parallelism. How can I exploit instruction-level parallelism? If I look at the von Neumann or Harvard principle, the execution is sequentially. So I execute one instruction after the other. If I want to exploit this instruction parallelism, I have, in fact, two possibilities. I can use parallelism in time, which is in fact the pipelining principle, or I can use parallelism in space, which is a concurrency principle. Concurrency principle is exploited by the superscalar processors, usually in combination with pipelining. So, these two techniques, in parallelism in time and parallelism in space, allow a really great performance increase compared to pure sequential operation. And both techniques are combined in modern processors today. So today's superscalar processor exploits pipelining, it exploits concurrency, and exploits multi-threading, and it exploits multi-core. So all the levels of parallelism are exploited on a today's modern microprocessor. When we just at the moment focus on the instruction level parallelism, we have these two principles, and parallelism in time means that the what I do is I take an instruction, I split this instruction into smaller parts, and then I overlap the execution of the smaller parts in time. This is what pipelining does, like a pipeline or a conveyor belt does. While parallelism in space is just a bit more simpler, I just take several execution units which allow me to execute instructions in parallel just by having parallel execution units, either in order or either out of order. We'll see at modern processors, even the instruction sequence as given by the programmer might be changed in the processor to optimize the execution. This would be out of order processing. Okay, here is a picture again comparing parallelism in space and parallelism in time. Parallelism in space just means I have three instructions and I have three execution units. Execution unit 1 executes instruction 1, execution unit 2 executes instruction 2, and execution unit 3 executes instruction 3 in parallel in a given time t. If I use pipelining or parallelism in time, I split the execution of a single instruction into phases. For instance, here we have 5 phases. And then I overlap these phases in time, which means I start executing the first phase of instruction 1. When I execute the second phase of instruction 1, I already start to execute the first phase of instruction 2. And when I start to execute the third phase of instruction 1, I start to execute the second phase of instruction 2, and I start to execute the first phase of instruction 3. And the idea behind this is following. When I split my instructions that way, so I have, let's say, my phases 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then I have an execution unit for phase 1, an execution unit for phase 2, execution unit for phase 3, and so on. First of all, I assign for instruction 1 the first phase to the corresponding unit which executes the first phase. When then it comes to the second phase, which means I assign for instruction 1, it's not for instruction 2, sorry, for instruction 1, the second phase to the second execution unit, the first unit here is free, has no work to do. So why not now assign here instruction 2, first phase? And so you see, in each clock cycle, a single instruction here occupies only one of the corresponding hardware units, and the others are free. So other units can be occupied by other instructions. So I get this assembly belt principle, or this pipelining principle here, which means I have splitted my instruction in several phases. For each phase, I have a hardware unit which is able to execute them. And when I start phase instruction 1, executing phase 1, then I start executing phase 2 of instruction 1, I can in parallel start phase 1 of instruction 2, and in the next step, when I start phase 3 of instruction 1, I can start in parallel phase 2 of instruction 2, and in parallel phase 1 of instruction 3, and so on. And this give some kind of a pipelining, and you see, even so, if this is triggered by a clock cycle, it takes 5 clock cycles, that example, to execute a single instruction. So instruction 1 takes 5 clock cycles to execute them. It takes 5 clock cycles to execute instruction 2. It takes 5 clock cycles to execute instruction 3. However, once the pipeline is filled, every clock cycle, one instruction is finished. So even so, the latency of an instruction still is 5 clock cycles. The throughput is 1 clock cycle per instruction. This is what we call a scalar processor. This is the huge benefit we get on pipelining. As well here, I think already here, it's quite easy to see why RISC is good for pipelining and CISC is bad for pipelining. Because this pipelining only works well if the execution time I need for these instructions are almost the same. If I have one instruction here which takes 10 times the execution time of the other, this messes up the entire pipeline. Another problem. In the first phase, maybe I fetch the first instruction. It's usually done in the first phase. So when I decode, this would be now decode in the second phase, was usually done, decode the first instruction, I have already to fetch the second instruction. But the problem is if I have variable instruction length, I don't know at that point in time where the second instruction starts. I know this at the end, usually here, but I need it here. So as well, variable instruction length is very bad for pipelining. Variable execution time for instruction is very bad for pipelining. Variable execution length often as well results if I have to access memory. And you remember in CISC, we don't have load store architectures, which means arithmetic operations are allowed to work on registers as well on memories. An arithmetic operation on a memory takes at least 10 times the time I need for an arithmetic operation on the register. So this is totally bad for this pipelining process because I have, you have an ad which is very short, you have an ad which is very long, messes up the pipeline completely. In RISC, I have as well this load and store instructions, but these are separate instructions. Or the arithmetic instructions only work within the internal registers, which fit very well for the pipeline. So already here you can see that RISC and pipelining fit smoothly together, while CISC and pipelining does not fit at all. Okay, just a citation from Peter Wehner from 1992, which mentioned that pipelining accelerates execution speed in the same way like Henry Ford revolutionized the car manufacturing with the introduction of the assembly line. So in fact, what I have to do when I want to use pipelining on a processor, I have to fragment the machine instruction into several partial operations. And then I can have on the other side, as I mentioned, partial units, which then execute these partial fragments, these fragments, in a sequential and synchronized manner in this pipeline principle. So every processing unit executes only one specific partial operation, as I mentioned, and all the partial processing units together are then called the pipeline. So all the execution units I have here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to execute this fragmented operation are called then the pipeline. Okay, how could we fragment our instruction cycle? To be honest, there are several, many possible possibilities to do that. The one I showed you here is a fragmentation into 5 stages. It's quite an obvious solution, resulting from the quite famous DLX pipeline, which is taken from literature, from the Hennessy Patterson book. However, many other possibilities exist, and today's processors have many, many pipeline stages. So, for instance, I know exactly from the Pentium 4, which divided the execution of an instruction into 28 stages. So it was split into 28 small pieces. Of course, you see, as smaller you make such a piece, as faster you can clock your pipeline, because the smaller you make a single piece, the shorter it takes to execute this piece, as fast as you can go run through your pipeline. On the other hand, we will see too long pipelines might introduce bad pipeline hazards, pipeline stalls, so it's always a compromise. So I want to show you here a quite obvious and simple fragmentation into five stages. The first stage is the instruction fetch, which means the instruction is addressed by the program counter and is loaded from the main memory or the cache to the instruction register. And at the same time, the program counter is incremented. So this would be the first fragmentation stage, the first stage of instruction execution. The second stage would then be the instruction decode, which means I take the opcode I've loaded in the first stage and now generate the control signals according to the instruction and the opcode and the addressing modes given in my instruction. The third stage would then be the operand fetch. So I take the operands from the internal registers, assume we have a load store architecture, or other functional units. The fourth state would then be the execute state, which means I just execute the operation with the operands. If I want to add two values, for instance, I do the operation, I do the real adding. And the fifth and last stage is then the write back stage. In the write back stage, I write the result back into the register, or in worst case, the main memory. So this would be an obvious, quite obvious separation or fragmentation of instruction into five stages, which then could be processed by the five-stage pipeline. Of course, it depends on the operation. There might be operations which need less stages, so operations which don't have an execute, for instance, operations which don't have a write back. So not every operation will run through all the five stages, but most of the operations should run all the five stages of the pipeline. And what we call then all these stages together would form our instruction cycle, which consists then of five stages. Okay, just a verbal explanation. So what we do in the first stage of our pipeline, we fetch the instructions. So we have a fetch unit. The first stage of the pipeline is a fetch unit, which fetches the instruction from the instruction cache or from the main memory. Then it hands over this instruction to the second unit, which is the decode unit. While this second unit processes the instruction, which means it decodes it, the fetch unit now already is able to fetch the next instruction. When the fetch unit knows what the next instruction is, which is easy if I have fixed instruction length, which is a hard task if I have variable instruction length. Because then the decode unit, if I have variable instruction length, the decode unit usually delivers the length of the instruction. And so I cannot fetch the instruction in parallel to decoding. So that's not good. But if I have fixed instruction length, this is easy. So in my best case scenario, if I have an n-stage pipeline, n instructions are executed in parallel because I have n instructions in different states of its execution in my pipeline. So each instruction is in a different stage of its execution. And when the pipeline is filled, as I mentioned, the execution of one instruction is finished every clock cycle. All stages are filled, every clock cycle, one instruction falls out at the end of the pipeline. And the processor, which is able to do this, this is what we call a scalar processor. One instruction per clock cycle means a scalar processor. In contrast then to the superscalar processors, which are able to finish more than one instruction per clock cycle, but this is not possible with pipelining, pure pipelining, there we have to introduce as well concurrency. This would be then a combination. Pipelining plus concurrency will deliver superscalar processors. Pipelining alone allows me to build a scalar processor. One instruction is finished each clock cycle. So here you can see our pipeline and how it works. So we start at the first clock cycle. So we fetch instruction one. Then we go to the second clock cycle. We decode instruction one while we fetch instruction two. We go to the third clock cycle. We fetch the operands of instruction one while at the same time we decode instruction two and at the same time we fetch instruction three. Then on the next clock cycle, we execute instruction one. We fetch the operands of instruction two. We decode instruction three and we fetch instruction 4, which is not shown here. And in the fifth clock cycle, we write back the results of instruction 1. At the same time, we execute instruction 2. We fetch the operands of instruction 3. We decode instruction 4, and we fetch instruction 5. And at that time, now the pipeline is filled. And from that point in time, every clock cycle, one instruction is finished. Here, the end of this clock cycle, we finish instruction 1. With the end of the next clock cycle, we finish instruction 2. At the end of the clock cycle, we finish instruction 3, and so on. So once the pipeline is filled, in a five-stage pipeline, of course, after 5 clock cycles, then every clock cycle, one instruction is finished. Okay, some remarks on the pipeline itself. The pipeline stages have to be linked somehow together. So I have to connect the decode stage, the fetch stage with the decode stage, and the decode stage with the operand fetch stage, and so on. And this connection usually is done by registers, because each stage here produces a result, and this result as the output works as the input for the next. So in fact, you have to as an example, let's take the first two stages. So we have the fetch stage, and the fetch stage delivers an instruction. And the decode stage then takes this instruction as an input and decodes it. If I would connect them directly, I would have a problem, because this instruction here is not valid for a long time, because once the fetch stage has fetched instruction I, it immediately starts fetching instruction I plus 1, which means the output gets unstable. So what I need is some kind of a register here to separate, which is clocked with the clock cycle. So during the clock cycle, the fetch stage fetches instruction 1. With the rising edge of the clock cycle, then this instruction, the fetch instruction, is stored in the register. And now, in the next clock cycle, here I fetch the next instruction. So this can get now unstable to get the next instruction, while the decode unit operates on the stored instruction in the register. And this is true for every pipeline stage. So always I have to connect two pipeline stages with a connecting register, because the output of one stage is the input of the next stage, and to keep the output stable, I need a register. And with every, let's say, rising clock, edge of the clock, the next value is stored to the register. So pipeline stages are linked by registers, and the instruction, the intermediate result, is forwarded every clock cycle. There are special overclocked pipelines which do it every half clock cycle, which change from one to the next stage on the rising and the falling edge. This would be an overclocked pipeline. Then to the next pipeline register. And of course, it's obvious that the pipeline is as fast as its slowest stage. So I have a pipeline of n elements. The slowest element in my pipeline determines the overall execution performance, because I have to order my clock cycle in a way. Again, let's assume I have three pipeline stages. The first pipeline stage takes 20 nanoseconds. The second takes 30 nanoseconds. And the third one takes 10 nanoseconds. Then, of course, my clock cycle for the pipeline is, or my clock period for the pipeline is 30 nanoseconds. I have to take the slowest stage in account. It's like a chain. It's the weakest part of the chain. So every 30 nanoseconds, I can switch, if I have this pipeline, the three stages. One, two, and three. I can switch every 30 nanoseconds, because if I would switch shorter than 30 nanoseconds, stage 2 wouldn't have enough time to produce a result, because it takes 30 nanoseconds from the input here to produce the output here. So I have to clock my pipeline with the clock of the slowest part of the stage, which would be the 30 nanoseconds. So therefore, this is one very important issue for the pipeline designer, to fragment my instruction in a way that each stage consumes about equivalent amount of time. Otherwise, I would have a really unbalanced pipeline. If I would have one stage which is very slow and others which are very fast, this wouldn't be useful. So I have to fragment it in a way that each stage has about the same execution time. Okay, as I mentioned already, as smaller I make my segments, which means as more fragments or segments I create, of course, as faster I can clock my pipeline. Let's assume I fragment my instruction into 5 pieces, having execution time of 20 nanoseconds each piece. Then I can execute my pipeline, run my pipeline at a period, clock period of 20 nanoseconds. If I now split it into 10 pieces, where each piece then only takes 10 nanoseconds execution time, I can double my clock frequency or half my cycle, then I can clock my pipeline the period of 10 nanoseconds. So in fact, as more stages I have, as higher the speed up will be. And a high number of pipeline stages is what often called a super pipeline. And don't confuse it with a superscalar pipeline. A super pipeline is just a pipeline with many pipeline stages, while a superscalar pipeline is a pipeline we'll learn later on, which has as well concurrency inside. So we have parallel pipeline stages, not only a parallelism in time, but as well parallelism in space. We'll see this later. So don't confuse super pipeline and superscalar pipeline. It's different. The problem on the other side is, later on we'll see that there are some reasons which causes a stall of the pipeline. And as longer the pipeline is, a small penalty I have to pay. Because usually when I have a pipeline stall, I have to make my pipeline empty. We'll learn later on control flow dependencies, which cause these kind of stalls. And this then causes on long pipelines long wait times until the pipeline can be refilled, which means you have some kind of a trade-off. As longer my pipeline, as larger my speed off will be, but as well, as more vulnerable my pipeline will be against pipeline hazards and pipeline stalls, so you have to do some kind of a trade-off. Okay, let's have a closer look on some pipeline measures. Let's do some quantitative analysis of the pipeline. So let's just define, we have an operation, and an operation is an application of a function f to operands. And this operation produces a result. And now I fragment my operation in a set of partial operations, f1 to fp, where p is the number of fragments I have, and k should be the number of pipeline stages I want to have. And usually I choose p identical to k. So if I fragment my operation into 5 pieces, I as well apply 5 pipeline stages. So usually p, the number of fragments of the operation, is identical to k, the number of pipeline stages. Now I execute these partial operations in a sequential order. And my instruction defines through its format the function, the operands, and the result. Okay, pipelining is a technique which takes place on the microarchitectural level. From the outside of the processor, outside is an architectural view. It's not visible if the processor operates with a pipeline or not. From the interface, the processor executes operations, regardless if it does it pipelined or non-pipelined. So pipelining is not visible from the interface level. So a programmer does not see if there's pipeline. At least in the ideal case, he should not see. So pipelining resides on the microarchitectural level. So pipelining is a microarchitectural technique. We will see as well superscalar, as what we look next, is as well a microarchitectural technique, while VLIW is an architectural technique, because VLIW processors, the parallelism is visible on the programmer level, on the interface level, but not in pipelining and not in superscalar. Okay, now look, if we have a K-stage pipeline and we want to execute n operations of our function f, how many cycles would we need? And we can give a formula for that. The number of clock cycles we need to execute n operations in the K-stage pipeline is K plus n minus 1. Why is this so? It's quite easy to explain. If the pipeline has k stages, then of course we need first, if the pipeline is empty initially, we need first k clock cycles to fill the pipeline. So after, assume we have an empty pipeline of k stages, it takes k clock cycles until the pipeline is filled. And after these k clock cycles, the first instruction is executed. And then, after the pipeline is filled, after k clock cycles, as I said, the pipeline is filled and the first execution instruction is finished, then we have n minus 1 instructions left to finish, but now, once the pipeline is filled, one instruction is finished each clock cycle, which means n minus 1 is then the n minus 1 cycles to execute the remaining n minus 1 instructions. So we need k cycles to fill the pipeline and to execute the first instruction, and n minus 1 clock cycles to execute the n minus 1 following instructions. This gives the overall number of clock cycles in k plus n minus 1. And I can show you this in an example. Here's an example. Let's assume we have to execute 10 instructions in a 5-stage pipeline. Let's select our 5-stage pipeline. According to our calculation, our formula, the number of clock cycles we need to execute 10 instructions in a 5-stage pipeline is 5. It's the k plus n minus 1 plus 10 minus 1, which results 5 plus 9 is 14. So we should need 14 clock cycles to execute the 10 instructions in our 5-stage pipeline. And here is a scheme, and you can see that this is true. So we start. Initially, the pipeline is empty. So we start with the startup or fill phase of the pipeline. In the first clock cycle, we assign instruction E to the first stage of the pipeline. In the second clock cycle, we assign E to the second stage of the pipeline, I plus 1 to the first stage of the pipeline. In the third clock cycle, we have I plus 2 in the first stage, I plus 1 in the second stage, I is now in the third stage. In the fourth clock cycle, I plus 3 is in the first stage, I plus 2 in the second, I plus 1 in the third, I is in the fourth stage. And in the fifth clock cycle, I plus 4 is in the first stage, I plus 3 is in the second, I plus 2 is in the third, I plus 1 is in the fourth, and I is in the last and fifth stage. So now the pipeline is filled, and it took 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 clock cycles to fill the pipeline, and after 5 clock cycles, instruction I is finished. So when this clock cycle is finished, the fifth clock cycle is finished, I is finished. So it took us 5 clock cycles to finish the first instruction due to the fill of the pipeline, the 5 here. Now, from now on, every clock cycle an instruction is finished. So on the next clock cycle, now I plus 1 is finished. On the next clock cycle, I plus 2 is finished. I plus 3, I plus 4, up to I plus 5. This is a standard processing phase of the pipeline. And in the end, we have the drain phase where the pipeline runs empty, which means now no new instructions are fed in. So now I plus 9 goes from here to here to here to here. But this has, of course, no effect at the end. Still, we then finish I plus 6, I plus 7, I plus 8, I plus 9. And after this clock cycle, all the 10 instructions are finished and the pipeline is empty again. And you see, we had the 5 to fill, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then the first instruction was finished. And then we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 clock cycles to execute the remaining 9 instructions. So here, the 5 plus 9, 14. Is exactly true in this model. So we can have this general principle that a pipeline of n stage of k stages takes k plus n minus 1 clock cycles to execute n instructions. Okay, now we can calculate some other interesting values, for instance, the throughput of the pipeline. The throughput usually is defined as the number of operations divided by the number of clock cycles I need to execute this operation. For instance, if I can execute 10 operations in 20 clock cycles, then I would have a throughput of 0.5. And ideally, once the pipeline is filled, each clock cycle an instruction is finished. So in a filled pipeline, I have obviously a throughput of 1 because it takes then one operation each clock cycle. But if the pipeline is not filled, of course, this is not true. So we can calculate it. So we have the number of operations divided by the number of clock cycles. The number of clock cycles we've calculated on the previous slide. This is this k plus n minus 1. Just take it here. The k plus n minus 1 is the number of clock cycles. And the number of operations, of course, is n. N, we execute n operations in k plus n minus 1 clock cycles. So the throughput is n divided by k plus n minus 1. And you see, this is, of course, below 1. So this value is smaller than 1. But if you would take large values for n, you would calculate the limits for n towards infinite, then you will see if n gets larger and larger, k is a constant value, it's the number of pipeline stages, you can neglect the k and you can neglect as well the 1. If you look at this formula for large values of n, and you see for large value of n, this converges towards 1. So, as more operations you have in the pipeline, as better you present the line, as better gets the throughput, and the maximum possible throughput is 1, which means 1 instruction per clock cycle is finished. We can as well calculate the pipeline speed up, which means we compare the numbers of operations or the execution time of an unpipelined processor with a pipeline processor. This gives me the speed up. As we know, for n instructions, to execute n instructions in a k-stage pipeline, the speed up is given by the number of cycles I need in my pipeline, which is again the k plus n minus 1 as before. And in the unpipeline processor, of course, I would need n times k because I have these k stages and I execute one instruction after the other. So for the first instruction, it takes k clock cycles. For the second instruction, it takes k clock cycles. If I do a pure unoverlapped, unpipeline processing. So I have a speed up of the pipeline of n times k divided by k plus n minus 1. And again, I can build, I can set up the limits for n towards infinite, which then results, if I make n larger and larger as well, you can neglect this k here. So if you make n larger, you can neglect this k here. You can neglect this minus 1. And the resulting value is n times k divided by n. And then you can remove the n. And the remainder is k. So in fact, for a large number of operations, the speed up, the pipeline deliver is exactly the number of pipeline stages k. So I have a 5-stage pipeline. This processor for a large number of instructions is 5 times faster than a non-pipeline processor. So this is what the pipeline speed up delivers. So it's meant in scenarios where a high number of linear succeeding operations executed, pipeline speed up converts to the number of pipeline stages. Okay, we can as well calculate the pipeline efficiency, which means how much contributes each pipeline stage to the speed up, which means we take the speed up we have and divide it by the number of pipeline stages. This gives us the efficiency of each stage. And this is, well, simple. We have the speed up. This is a speed up from the previous slide here. This part here is exactly what we calculated here as a speed up. Take this here, divide it by k. So we get an efficiency of n divided by k plus n minus 1. And again, we can see what happens if we make n quite large. And if we make n quite large, we get here, we can neglect the k, the minus 1, and we end up in a 1. So which means for a large pipe, for a large number of operations, the efficiency of each pipeline stage, in fact, is a value of 1. So it contributes by a value of 1 to the overall speedup. Okay, this all is true if I have an infinite number of operations, an infinite operation stream, without any bubbles in the pipeline. Bubbles means for some reason I cannot fill some pipeline stages, so then a bubble is created in the pipeline or some stalls. So what we have here is a best case analysis. The real performance is of course lower. I don't want to go into detail on that, I just want to present you one possible Brachtig aberration. One Brachtig aberration are the so-called Hockney numbers. And there are several Hockney numbers which define pipeline performance. The ideal one is the N infinite. So this is really the pipeline peak performance we have here at an infinite number of operations. So this is the N infinite. More realistically is the N half Hockney number, which is the number of operations at which the pipeline reaches its half peak performance. So how many operations do I need to get the half of the peak performance? This means here an efficiency of 0.5 or a throughput of 0.5. This is N half. There are more Hockney numbers exist, and the Hockney numbers really, these are theoretical values which are calculated, best case values. The Hockney numbers are measured on a real pipeline. Okay, as you see, as I sketched already here, here's a bit more in detail. Stages, we have the pipelines, we have the functionality F. The functionality F is split into fragments. Each fragment is executed by a pipeline stage. Fragment 1, fragment 2, fragment 3, up to fragment K, if I have K stages. And each state is separated by a register from the next stage. So here I input is my instructions and operands, and at the output, at the end, I get my result. Okay, as I mentioned, a pipeline only works efficiently if all the stages here in the pipeline, if I go back to the previous slide, if all the stages here have about the same execution time. So what can I do if I find out I have some kind of an unbalanced pipeline? So I have one stage which is significantly slower than the other stages. So in that case, I have two possibilities. I can partition this in time or can partition it in space. Partitioning in time means I take this partial operation F, which takes time TF, and I try to split it in two subparts, which can be executed one after the other. And these subparts hopefully just need the time TF half. The problem is, for some operations, this is not possible. So there might be operations which cannot be split into two parts, because it's some kind of an atomic operation which I cannot easily split. In that case, I have another possibility. I can apply the functionality now not at the time TF half, do not split it, but I just take the functionality two times, still the time TF, so I do not change my pipeline stage, but I replicate my pipeline stage into two pieces and now assign my module F alternately. And this produces the same result, and I will show you this in an example. In fact, it's the same result, and I give you an example of this partitioning. Let's start first with the pipeline, with the left approach on the left side. So on the first clock cycle, at time t, I assign instruction I to the first stage. At t plus 1, I assign I plus 1 to the first stage. I goes to the second stage. Then T plus 2, I plus 2 is on the first stage, I plus 1 is on the second stage. T plus 3, I plus 3 is on the first stage, I plus 2 is on the second stage. And then let's assume this is what we want to execute at the T plus 4, I plus 3 is in the second stage, and at time T plus 5, everything is done. And now, assigning the operations alternately, produce exactly the same result. So at time t, I assign instruction I to the function unit here. At time t plus 1, I assign I plus 1 here. And you see now, instruction I resides for two clock cycles here. And since here we have TF half, and since the instruction resides for two clock cycles, now we have time for TF. So on the next T plus 2, now we assign I plus 2 here. You see, as well, I plus 1 was able to reside for two clock cycles here. And now we do this alternate assignment, I plus 3, and we finish it. And at type T plus 5, we have the same result. So that from the timing behavior, these two operate in the same way. Here, each partial operation, so we have split it F in two parts. Each part takes the time F half, and each and resides for the time F half in his stage. Here we haven't partitioned the operation, but we have replicated the functional unit. Every time TF half, we assign an instruction alternatively, which means each individual instruction resides for two clock cycles, which means TF half times two, which means TF for the time TF in its execution unit, thus as well filling all the constraints. So in fact, we have the same behavior. Okay, this is what you can do for balancing pipeline sub-operations. So if you have such an unbalanced pipeline where you have a function unit F2, which execution time is much larger than F1 and much larger than F3, then you have the possibility to split this either in a sequential way, so make the pipeline longer, this is one possibility, or in a parallel way if you cannot split it by just having parallel function units. And it works as well, not only by two as we had here, but as well by three, four, and so on. So, in general, if I want to determine the clock frequency in my pipeline, of course the maximum for the execution time for TF1 up to TFK in a K-stage pipeline determines the clock frequency. And if this, if I have here one element, TFI, which is much larger than TF1 up to TFK, then I should take this FI and should either partition it in that way or partition it in that way to get a balanced pipeline. So I should look at my pipeline, find out where are unbalanced parts, and then partition it in either one or the other way. Okay, this leads then to the overall execution time and clock frequency. If I have a pipeline execution of an operation F, and the overall time, of course, is not speed up for the pipeline. You see, the processor finishes an operation each clock cycle, but the execution time, the latency of a single operation, still is the number of pipeline stages. The number of pipeline stages and the number of pipeline multiplied with a clock period. And the clock period is given, of course, of the maximum of my individual pipeline stages. So I look at the execution time of my individual pipeline stages. I take the slowest one, and this determines my clock frequency. Unfortunately, this is not the entire truth. As I've shown here, and we've seen in the picture, we have between two pipeline stages, we have a register. And this register, as well, has some timing constraints. This register has usually a propagation delay, so when I get the input here, put the input in the register, it takes some propagation delay, TBD, from the input to get to the output. So for the overall speed up, or for the overall clock cycle or period of the pipeline, I have not only to consider the delay of the stage itself, but as well the delay of my register, which means I had to find the maximum delay of my stages plus my propagation delay of my register. And even this is not the complete truth, because there's another time I have to obey, which is called the so-called setup time. And the setup time of a register means, if I look at my data, this is my data I want to get on the register, and this is my clock. So this is my clock cycle. And let's assume we have an active rising edge clock cycle. At the rising edge of the clock cycle, the data is taken or is taken from the register. Then the setup time is defined as a time I have to set up the data before the rising edge of a clock cycle. Each real physical register has such a setup time. So when I would deliver the data exactly at the rising edge of the clock cycle, the data would not be taken to the register in a reliable way. So I need to have or to obey some kind of a setup time. I have to get my data a bit far before the rising edge of the clock cycle to get a stable and a reliable taking of the value into the register. So in fact, I have to calculate the overall delay here. I have to take in account the delay of the stage. I have to take in account the delay of the register, and I have to take in account the setup time of the register. And this takes this formula, the maximum of the delay of the single stages plus the propagation delay plus the setup time. This corresponds to the clock cycle times the number of stages. This gives the overall time I need to execute an operation, and I can rephrase this to that formula, while the clock frequency is given by the maximum TFI plus TPD plus TSU. Okay, I think finally for today we can look at a concrete example. It's a bit better, but I don't think I can do anything against these reflections here. Okay, we have here a five-stage pipeline, and here a sketch of a processor with a five-stage pipeline is shown. And we start with a program counter. In fact, the program counter is the first register of the pipeline because it contains the address of the. It does not work. There is a gap on the side between. So, in fact, the program counter is the first register of the pipeline, which addresses the next operation to be fetched. So, in fact, the fetch stage of the pipeline uses the program counter to access the instruction cache, and finally to store the fetched instruction in the instruction register, while at the same time the PC is incremented. So, this is what the fetch state does. Here you see the separation register between the fetch stage and the decode stage. In fact, is the instruction register. The decode stage takes the instruction from the instruction register, which has been loaded one clock cycle before, decodes it, and creates the control signals to access then the register file, and as well to control the ALU for the operation. And these control signals are stored in the control register. So this is the next separation register, which then has the control signals. Okay, with the control signals, now I can address my register file and select, for instance, two operands from the register file. So in fact, I take these control signals, which contain, for instance, the register numbers. With these two register numbers I have here, I can now access in parallel two registers, and as a result, I get two operands. And you see here, the next separation register between the operand fetch and the execute state, in fact, are two registers, one register for operand one and one register for operand two. But in fact, you can see this as a large register. Okay, in the next, in fact, what's not signed here, but the operands are not the only thing you need here. To make it a bit more detailed, you need as well here some kind of a control register, because here you have not only, of course, from the decoding of the instruction, not only have the operand addresses, but as well you have to have decoded what has to be done with the operands. So the opcode, and the opcode as well has to be delivered here, and then, of course, controls the ALU. So in fact, you have a third part of the register, which contains the opcode or some sub-opcode, which then tells the ALU what to do. So based on this opcode, the two operands then are processed. The result is taken, and the result is stored in the next register, which is the next separation register between the execution phase and the write-back phase. And now depending on what you have, if you have a load store architecture, the write-back phase would be here. This part here in the last clock cycle would be just writing back the operands to the result operand to the register file. This would be the write-back stage of the pipeline. If you allow write-back as a memory access, then we would have here the operand and the address. We need not only the operand, but as well the address here. So in fact, use here usually two values. One would be the operand to store. The other would be the address for a store operation. With the address part, you address the data cache. With the operand part here, with the value, is the contents of the data cache. And then you write the value to the data cache. As well, you can see if we have a store operation. A store operation as well works in this pipeline. So it's identical in the fetch phase, in the decode phase, in the operand fetch phase for a store operation. We fetch, in fact, the address of the for a load, so not for a store, for a load operation, just as a store, we are in the load operation. In the fetch phase of a load operation, we fetch, in fact, the address of the value we want to load. So then, after that, we have here the address of the value we want to load. And then we can, again, with the address, access our data cache, and then get the operand in the operand register, which then can be written to the register file. But you see, depending on what type of operations if I have a arithmetic operation, a load operation, or a store operation, there are it's identical up to here, but then it splits up and there are several paths in the pipeline which can be taken, and even some operations don't need all the stages of the pipeline. Finally, we can see as well a jump or a branch operation. Branch operation as well is the same as here. Instruction fetch, decode, operand fetch. Operand fetch in place of a branch operation means I fetch the address where I want to branch. And then this might be some kind of not the effective address. We've seen when looking at addressing modes that there might be some calculation. For instance, we want to branch relative to an index register, which means we have in fact two operands, a base value and an index register we have to add here. So here in the execution stage, then we really calculate the effective branch address where we want to branch to, and then we load in the write-back phase. Write-back phase means here we load the new address to the program counter. So we see it depends on what to do. I think as well this makes it quite obvious that a load store architecture has big advantages in the pipeline, because here in the load store architecture, I either have the path through the pipeline here back to the register file, or here to the cache, or here from the cache. I don't have a necessity to calculate operands from the operand registers, two operands from the operand from the register file, and then store them to the memory, because then I would have a problem. I would need a third part, because then I have operand one, operand two, but I need as well the address where to store it here in the register. And here I don't have this, so I would need here a third register for the operand address, which would make things more complicated. As well, as something we will see in more detail in the next lecture, but which can be seen as well here. Just imagine we fetch an instruction, then we decode it, and after here, we determine it's a branch instruction, so we load the program counter. The problem is, when we load the program counter and then fetch the next instruction, we have already wrongly fetched some other instructions, because let's assume we have the branch instruction. We fetch the branch instruction, we decode the branch instruction, and we fetch already the next instruction. Then we get the operands, so we already fetch the next instruction. Then we calculate the branch address and always calculate the next instruction. Then we load the new PC, we already get the next instruction. After that, we finish the instruction we want to branch to. And if you count it, you've seen I have fetched four wrong instructions before I get to the branch. So I have a branch instruction, but the instructions after the branches are even fetched and partly executed, even so there is a branch. And this is a typical possibility for a pipeline stall or pipeline hazard, because we have to do something, which means in case we detect here in the decoded branch, in fact, we have to stop here, because we have to do something on that, that we don't execute wrong instructions. But this is belongs to the chapter of pipeline stalls and pipeline hazards. This is something which would be our next topic in the lecture, and this we will discuss next week. Okay, that's for today. Thanks.